So, welcome again. I'm pleased to that you've all given us this gift. For the past 15 years, I have had the good fortune of writing and teaching and researching lived theology. And it has been my privilege to carry out this work in the company of a very exciting and challenging group of practitioners and scholars and activists and theologians. I was introduced, I've told the story before, so bear with me, but I always like to tell it again. I was introduced not too long ago as the director of the project on Livid Theology. And I do think that may be sort of an apt description of some things I've written in the past couple of years, but I still think that it's not quite time to change it just yet. This project on lived theology is housed here in the Department of Religious Studies at UVA, and it is part of a national reconsideration of the theological vocation, focused on the methodological centrality of faith's redemptive practices in the world. Our project is based on the rationale that the patterns and the practices of Christian communities, of religious communities, offer rich and constructive and generative material for theological inquiry. These patterns and practices of Christian community, they're not simply ways of doing things, but they are also ways of saying things. That is to say, these patterns and practices of lived experience in the life of faith are communicative. They are communicative of God's ways in the world. So they're not simply, you know, artifacts or rituals of interest for social scientific analysis, but they are theologically real and deep in their integrity. Well, what does it mean to appropriate, to use the lived experience of faith with the same care and with the same precision that we use text and books to form our judgments and to form our understandings? Might that kind of task, that is, attending to the patterns and practices of faith, offer new models for partnerships such as this between scholars and students and practitioners and pastors? These are some of the central questions and I think some of the exciting concerns that are essential to our work. Many of our students here, and you've seen this in the places you teach, bring with them an intense hunger for the opportunity to reconnect theology and life. And for this reason, I think the theological turn to practice, which we are pursuing here, but which you see across the United States in churches and in academic institutions, has found a welcome and dynamic culture in the academy, where I sort of spend my days, for better or ill, and alas, in this public university where I teach. It's encouraging to see creative synergies working across fields and traditions with maximum attention to the theological depth of worship, liturgy, preaching, teaching, the work of mercy and justice, and the quotidian goings-on of everyday life. In a profound sense, I think, those of us gathered here this afternoon, despite differences of specialization, of vocation, of calling, of denominational background, of, you know, theological orientation, we all share a common commitment to creating spaces in our lives and in our communities and in our institutions that foster the revitalization of theology through and in practice. I think of the enterprise of lived theology in this way, as the work of creating spaces such as this, where what Dietrich Bonhoeffer once called the turning from the phraseological to the real is enabled and nourished. So we surely do not presume, you know, to script the work of the Spirit, to kind of, you know, subject it to our own expectations, to turn the freedom and adventurousness of the life of faith and theological growth, you know, into some kind of a pedagogical formula that we then in turn impose on our students. Still, I have seen how the imaginative use of resources, both resources provided generously by such endowments as the Lilly Endowment and other resources, coupled with creative organizing and creative design of programs and events, brings to life spaces that encourage and I think energize a new way of teaching and writing theology. Serene Jones, the theologian formerly at Yale, now the president of Union Theological Seminary in New York, in a wonderful essay, in a volume of essays edited by Craig Dykstra and, I'm forgetting your name, at Valparaiso, called For Life Abundant. Don't keep this, like, edit that out, okay? That part right there. In a wonderful volume, offers a very encouraging forecast when she says, Serene says, that theologies of practice and this kind of theological turn to practice may well be poised to take a strong lead over other disciplines in charting a new, enlivened course for a form of theological education that is both globally responsive and intellectually rich. That's great, isn't it? Well, in any case, I hope that these 2 days together, 2.5 days, help us to sort of clarify the challenges and the promise and the promises of this new course. As I mentioned earlier, this year's SILT deviates slightly from the models of the previous 3 years, specifically in that the theme of this year's Spring Institute gathers around the life and legacy of a single individual and a related movement. But I still think this year's Institute, one that I'm, as you can imagine, terribly excited about, fits nicely with our previous work and with the whole mission of our work, of our project here, in its intent to locate rich and sometimes untapped theological sources outside the academy. So we turn to the life and thought and legacy of John Perkins with the concern to ask, how can his life and his witness and his thought be used, be appropriated, be taken and borrowed as a theological resource for congregations and for the academy? And I want to emphasize that point that about a theological resource. That is to say that Perkins' work has inspired a model that has influenced hundreds, if not thousands, of community development ministries around the United States. I kind of like to think of the Perkins model in relation to an interesting book written by a sociologist named Doug McAdam, called Freedom Summer, a study of the 1964 Freedom Summer movement. And McAdam, who's a sociologist, makes a convincing argument, and it's not just a theoretical argument, he's actually doing case studies and following through, you know, field work and interviews, the lives of those who came to Mississippi as student organizers, as student volunteers, to work alongside local people in 1964, in turn became the leaders of the 60s countercultural initiatives and youth movements, whether it was anti-war, feminist work, free speech, pursuit of an alternative consciousness, the turn east, whatever, that that 1964 Mississippi was kind of a training ground that energized this generation of activists. And I think a similar kind of argument can be made about the work of Voice of Calvary, that over the years, dozens and hundreds of thousands of men and women from all over the nation, and I think now all over the world, have imbibed the model, have taken part in it, have learned about the model, and have gone back in their communities, and in sometimes very, very different ways, but nonetheless in the spirit of the three R's, reconciliation, redistribution, and relocation, have helped bring in a new generation of faith-based activists and organizers. So, John Perkins, you know, I have the story I want to tell you, and I'm sorry, but I want to say just a few things before we get started, and then you really won't hear from me. Well, you hear from me at 7 o'clock, but mostly just getting John to tell his story. But as we think about Perkins' life and legacy, I think of this 1994 Freedom Summer Project reunion that I attended, the 30th anniversary of that great, you know, initiative that brought 1,000 or so students down to work alongside Bob Moses and Ms. Hamer and Victoria Gray and so many others, Cleve Sellers, Stokely Carmichael, Ed King, in the Mississippi movement. And it was a glorious week. You know, all the movement sort of celebrities were there, and then a lot of folks sort of who, you know, were kind of unsung heroes. And there was amazing music. Bernice Reagan Johnson gave this concert on Thursday night, and by the end, we were all just, you know, who had fallen to pieces. And she began, you know, "Come go with me to that land. Come go with me to that land where I'm bound." And it was like we were going with her to sort of revisit that time and that place. The last day of the conference that I was attending with John Perkins' late son, Spencer, who was a very dear friend of mine and many of yours, and his sort of, you know, reconciliation partner, Chris Rice, who's now at the Center for Reconciliation at Duke. On the last day of that gathering, there was a celebration of all the men and women who remained in Mississippi after the Freedom Summer Volunteers moved on to sort of, you know, sexier things, and sort of kept the hand to the plow and took the baton and, you know, stuck it out for the long haul. And it was a wonderful occasion, and there was a screen with names and photographs coming down. There were probably 25 or 30 names. Missing from that list were the names Vera May and John Perkins. And I thought, okay, I don't quite understand this, but someone needs to expand the narrative of the civil rights story in order to affirm the importance of the Perkins story, which is precisely the story of someone coming kind of late to the movement. 68, it wasn't until 1969 that he stood on the, you know, Simpson County Courthouse organizing this boycott of white businesses in Mendenhall, and said, you know, we're, in the words of Fannie Lou Hamer, "We're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and we're not going to take it anymore." But nonetheless, it was that kind of story, if anything was going to happen, to build on the successes of the civil rights movement, on this, you know, trinity of disciplines that SNCC so well rehearsed in its best years: incarnational organizing, nonviolent direct action, and a certain kind of deliberate interracialism, and other attendant practices as well. It was going to be the men and women who were, you know, left in these ordinary backwater hamlets, without the attention of all the famous moms and dads of the Freedom Summer Volunteers, without the attention of the national media. And John Perkins' story is, in a large part, the story of that unfinished business, if you will, of the civil rights movement. Well, one of the questions we might want to explore is why was his story overlooked? Even in that wonderful book, Local People by John Dittmer. It's just a fabulous book. Reads like a big Russian novel, the history of the civil rights movement in Mississippi. There's no reference to John and Vera May. I'd like to hear your responses to that over the next day or two. Certainly his sort of rich gumbo, you know, of black nationalism, Bible-centered piety, some good old-fashioned otherworldliness and holiness, a kind of, socialist thing on the one hand and the capitalist thing on the other hand. A pro-life, pro-business, pacifist Pentecostal who likes Chuck Colson and Stokely Carmichael and campaigned for Barack Obama. So, it's a complicated legacy. It seems to me that Dr. Perkins' vision has not only been neglected by historians, and the story has been neglected by historians, but that his vision, his life, and legacy has also not been appreciated fully for its theological promise. I would like to know that when I'm dead and gone, the story and the life and work of John Perkins will be taught in the theology departments in the United States, not simply in, pastoral ministry, which is great, or history, or sociology, but that he's taught as a theologian. This means, of course, that some of you need to get together and edit, the John Perkins Complete Writings or John Perkins Reader. And I know we'll talk about a book that's coming out of this conference later with sort of some essays in which we try to move in that direction. So this means that we begin to think about his contribution not only to congregations and grassroots organizations, but also his legacy as a theologian and an intellectual. And this raises a host of questions, which I lay out here for our consideration. And I want to remind us and reassure you at this point that one of the things we're doing differently in this year's SILT is building in a lot more time for open exchange of ideas in sort of unstructured sessions. How can his life and work be appropriated and articulated as a theological resource? How does his life and work exemplify a new or underdeveloped or marginalized trajectory for American evangelicalism, particularly with its emphasis on conversion as renewed social practices, conversion as the forming of habits of reconciliation, community building, and peacemaking? That's a question. I mentioned this story from the fall of 1969 in the town of Mendenhall when Perkins led this boycott of white businesses and, of course, paid the price for that. The account of his arrest and his beating and torture in a Brandon city jail is one of the most harrowing stories from the civil rights movement, alongside that torture of Miss Hamer in a Winona city jail in 1963. But it's an interesting, and we'll talk more about that tonight. Dr. Perkins will talk more about that tonight. But this is 1969 and 1970. The Perkins returned from California in 1960. So what had he and they and the Voice of Calvary Ministry been up to for 9 years? A very interesting question. Perkins says, Spencer once told me, so my mom and dad came back from Mississippi in 1960. Their idea was to work among their own people. And you know that phrase in the Deep South. If you were African American, but people knew that you were just working among your own people, it was considered, this was not so much a threat because it was about African-American uplift and that, which is, an important story. But this was the intention. Spencer said that their idea was that by equipping poor African-Americans with biblical literacy and with the right doctrine, which in this case was premillennial dispensationalist, that the local African Americans and poor blacks would have the renewed spirits and the new vocabulary and would be equipped with the resources to become independent. And John will later say, you know, I didn't come back from California to Mississippi in 1960 with anything like a holistic gospel. It took me a while to find it. It didn't take that long, of course, to realize that trying to change the Jim Crow South by biblical literacy and a tutorial on doctrine was not quite going to do the trick. So what had he been doing for these 10 years, and what were the sources of his theological and political transformations? I actually think that's a very important story to understand. As you know, after 1970, John began to talk about the three R's, this new trinity of disciplines that would become the core of his expanded ministry. And these three R's are, of course, relocation, redistribution, and reconciliation. Relocation, John once said, I like Stokely Carmichael's definition. Every cat's politics comes from what he sees when he gets up in the morning. The liberals see Central Park, and we see sharecropper shacks. A relocation was about where you get up in the morning. The activist and the organizer, in the spirit of SNCC's incarnational organizing, cease to patronize the poor when he or she lives in community with them in the spirit of compassion and with a willingness to serve. Redistribution. Redistribution meant sharing talents and resources with the poor, but it also, and this is one of the places where I think white evangelicals have not given a fair or honest representation of Perkins' life and legacy. Redistribution means sharing talents and resources with the poor in that wonderful flow and exercise of charity. But it also means observable changes, real changes in public policy. It means observable changes in public policy favorable to distressed and excluded communities. And I throw this out just as an FYI, but if you read back through all of Perkins' essays in these sort of left-wing evangelical journals that he was writing in the late in the early 70s, Post-America, is that right? Was that the name of Post-America before Sojourner? And then Freedom Now, which turned into The Other Side. You will see a series of essays, pieces on reparations for slavery. And Perkins once said to me, reparations for, not to me, but in one of these essays, reparations for slavery is basically a Christian response to the hurt and harm of and the treacherous centuries of white racism. And I actually have never heard him say anything that would dispute that earlier comment. Maybe we can talk to him about that. I think it'd be very interesting. Indeed, quite apart from specific policy recommendations, however, Perkins imagined that the Christian community would represent and embody a distinctive social order. It would be a new humanity. It would be a new order that models in its practices the redistribution of wealth in ways that are both a witness to the social and economic order, but also a model for the social and economic order. Reconciliation. Reconciliation meant embodying the message that you are all one in Christ Jesus and that Christ has destroyed the barrier, dividing wall of hostility between men and women, slave and free, Jew and Gentile. Perkins believed that the brotherhood, the demonstration of a brotherhood or sisterhood of intertwined lives, even if that demonstration was only, you know, a diverse group of people sitting on the porch of a Voice of Calvary house at the end of a summer day, drinking a glass of ice, sweetened iced tea, talking about the work of building beloved community, that kind of visible demonstration had the power to subvert the God-forsaken spaces of Southern and American segregation, unlike any individual act of heroism. And in this sense, John would agree with an interesting remark made by an unlikely visitor to the United States in 1967, a German theologian named Helmut Thielicke. Thielicke spoke at Harvard Divinity School, and he was asked in a conversation with students to talk about his disappointment with the sad state of the civil rights movement circa 1967 and what went wrong. And Thielicke, who had been observing this, you know, from Germany, but certainly had paid the price as a resistor against Hitler earlier in his life, said, you know, I think SNCC, for all of its wonderful work, was just impatient with the small steps. It wanted to change too much too quickly. He said, if anything is going to change beyond the removal of the legal structures of injustice, it's going to have to be done in homeopathic dosages. This is the word Thielicke said, in homeopathic dosages. And I think that, you know, this idea of relocation, reconciliation, speaks to the theological and I think the countercultural power of intentional communities and intentional gatherings that are interracial. In any case, the hard work of reconciliation, as you know, for the Perkins model, was an altogether different matter than emotional catharsis or kind of therapeutic or psychological affirmation. It required the material compensation of whites in the disciplines of relocation and redistribution in the restoration of justice. Charlie Sherrod, one of the great unsung heroes, a Virginian who set up the first SNCC office in Southwest Georgia in 1962, and a minister, had once remarked that reconciliation depends on the prior condition of the person who says no to injustice, but is then actively involved in correcting the injustices. So while reconciliation may indeed produce handshakes and hugs and tears of reunion and the like, wonderful things, for Perkins, without a corrective action, it is empty, or it is insufficient. So the three R's. We know these three R's, but I would like us to ask in the course of our time together, are these three R's, this trinity of disciplines, still a viable model for community building and faith-based activism in 2009, 2010? I think we need to think through that and think perhaps critically about that. Most importantly, students of the Perkins model, and I think this may be one of the most important of his contributions, want to make us not forget that in the course of Perkins' life and writings, he offers us the contours of a theology of economic justice. Perkins said time and again that the gospel involves redemptive release from all forms of physical and economic oppression, and that Jesus, whose message, Perkins says, was explicitly economic, identified with the poor to the point of giving his life to the liberation of the poor. Perkins is sometimes regarded, as you know, as the father of the evangelical faith-based movement, and this may be so. But if it is, I think it also reminds us that the faith-based movement has radical roots in some of the 60s most innovative experiments in organizing, and that the faith-based movement in Perkins' story was about learning to read the Bible as the comprehensive divine plan for human flourishing. And while reading the Bible as a comprehensive divine plan of human flourishing from the perspective of God's own welfare system, which is more radical than any human welfare system, while this may not translate to specific partisan loyalties, for Perkins it sometimes may. And in any case, it undoubtedly requires some degree, a great degree of public advocacy for economic policies preferential to the poor. And so I say, let's ask, what are the public policy implications of the Perkins story? Finally, let me leave with one final, let me finish with one final remark. Whether this is critical or not, I don't think it is. Actually, from things I've heard John saying in recent years, I would suspect that there is a profound and exciting shift in his thinking along these lines. Fannie Lou Hamer, Ms. Hamer, as you know, once described the civil rights movement and her work in the bounty of God and the life of faith that was so exuberantly manifest in the movement in terms of a welcoming table. The kind of welcoming table you would see in the back and still see in the back of a yard of many rural churches in the South. And at the welcoming table of the movement, at the welcoming table of justice, at the welcoming table of God, Ms. Hamer said, everyone is invited to come to eat. Those special homecoming Sundays and dinners on the ground, you know, when we bring all that wonderful food from the Deep South, which people up this far north call soul food, but when I was growing up in Mississippi, we called food, right, Peter? They'll bring that to the table, you know, blackberry cobbler and fried chicken and collard greens and black-eyed peas and field peas and cream corn, cornbread, sweetened tea, sweetened while the pot, the water is boiling, and not like this pouring this, you know, the sugar in the glass after it's already been made. Everyone was invited to come to the welcoming table, even Ross Barnett. And even James O. Eastland, they would have to learn some manners at the welcoming table, but they were invited too. And so throughout her life, Ms. Hamer spoke of the experience of her life in the movement as the stirrings of a new kingdom right here on earth. She compared the student volunteers from the summer to the Good Samaritan, reading Jesus' parable as a description of the new kingdom emerging amidst the scorched summer fields of the Mississippi Delta. Like the self-righteous priest and the Levite in the biblical account who passed by the wounded man without concern for his welfare, Southern white Christians had turned their sights from African-American suffering, and as Ms. Hamer said, never taken the time to see what was going on. But this was not true of the summer volunteers who came to Mississippi. Although strangers like the Samaritan in Jericho, they never hesitated to act with compassion towards people they found hurting and depressed. Although they were strangers, Ms. Hamer said, they were the best friends we ever met. To me, she said, if I had to choose today between the church and these young people, referring quite directly now to two Jewish young men, Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman, who became some of the first martyrs of the civil rights movement along with James Chaney in 1964. If I had to choose today between the church and these people, and I was brought up in the church, and don't get me wrong, I'm not against the church, I'd choose these young people. They did something here that gave us the hope that we had prayed for so many years. We wondered if there was anybody human enough to see us as human beings instead of animals. These young people, so many not Christian, were still so Christ-like. So clearly a rich and complex theological vision is implicit in this generous imagery of the welcoming table, one that illustrates, I think, an expansive and embracive vision. The hospitality of the welcoming table was not the possession of the church. It was not the possession of the Christian. It was a gift that all people were called to take part in. Thomas Merton once said, "Our calling as Christians does not make us superior to other people. We do not have the answers to every social problem, and all conflicts have not been decided beforehand in favor of our side. Our job in these late days is to learn to struggle along with everybody else and collaborate with them in the difficult, frustrating task of seeking a solution to common problems which are entirely new and strange to us all." So I raise that point to ask about the Perkins model. How can we think it or rethink it or retrieve it in a way that opens up partnerships and coalitions and builds bridges and links arms with people outside the evangelical church, the Protestant church, the church, the Christian faith, and in this common work of mercy and justice. And with that, I close my overly long comments, but I hope those are helpful in kind of setting the stage for the work ahead. Thanks.